May it please the court. My name is Mark Evans, number 40156, public defender, and I represent Mr. Rondell Lockley. Your Honor, I see that my time is now running. Thank you. there are several issues in the opening brief that warrant reversal in this case, and I'm happy to answer questions about any of them. But I'm going to focus my argument this morning on the trial court's decision not to suppress an unmirandized statement taken from Mr. Lockley by a police officer in the station house. And the law has been clear since the United States Supreme Court issued Miranda that a defendant's statement made during custodial interrogation is inadmissible as evidence in the prosecution's case in chief, unless the defendant has been warned of and waived certain constitutional rights. And the trial court here found that Mr. Lockley was in custody, and there's never been any dispute about whether he was warned of his rights or whether he waived them. He didn't, and he wasn't.
Particular statement that you're concerned about here is which one?
The single
made a couple of statements.
That's correct. And the single most damaging statement for Mr. Lockley was that I didn't do anything to the victim. She slept on the couch. And that's the second of two similar statements. There was one to the effect of, I didn't do anything to her. The second was, she slept on the couch. And that was the statement that clearly implies that they did not have sex.
And that was not in response to any question as to whether he did anything to the victim or not, was it?
It was in response to, hold on, transcript. When Mr. Lockley said, or as the officer recalls, as Mr. Lockley said, he told me he didn't do anything with the girl he helped at the bus stop, and then the officer was the one who contradicted that and said, yes, you did. And that is when Mr. Lockley made the statement, you didn't do anything to that girl, she slept on the couch. So express questioning, perhaps not, but certainly the functional equivalent thereof.
I'm not sure I agree with your reading, as I understand it. He said, does it have something to, I'm quoting, he then said, does it have something to do with the girl at the bus stop? I told him, yes, it did have something to do with the girl at the bus stop. He told me he didn't do anything with the girl he helped at the bus stop. I said, yes, it did. It doesn't say, yes, you did. It said, yes, it did. He told me he didn't do anything to that girl and she slept on the couch.
Right, and there's a number of different explanations for that. I tend to think that the most likely is that that's a typographical error in the transcript. But even if the word really was it, yes, it did, I don't know what meaning that could be assigned other than to indicate, to serve as an indication from the officer to Mr. Lockley that he didn't believe that he didn't do anything with that girl. And at the time that statement was made, the officer who was there with Mr. Lockley, he already knew what the allegations were. He already knew that a rape kit had been conducted. He knew that something happened with the victim, and thus was in a position when Mr. Lockley denied that anything happened with the victim to contradict him.
Well, that's the interrogative statement by the detective that you're saying was improper.
That's correct. And both of those first two statements end up getting used against Mr. Lockley at trial. I didn't do anything and she slept on the couch. But it's the she slept on the couch that's the most clearly the product of the officer questioning or performing the functional equivalent of questioning of Mr. Lockley. And I think that the pertinent facts that go into the analysis of whether an interrogation occurred here are largely undisputed, and they're reflected in exactly the passage that we're looking at right now. But the other key fact that needs to be taken into consideration as we do this analysis is that at pretrial motions hearing, the officer who was there contacting Mr. Lockley said that the reason he was there was I wanted him to talk to me. Now, The inquiry for determining whether, based on those facts, an interrogation occurred was explained by the Colorado Supreme Court last year in Bonilla Barraza. And that inquiry focused.
Yeah, let me just say, he did say I wanted to talk to him, and obviously he did. I don't think there's any dispute about that. He was going in to do an interrogation when the man, and I think that the state's position would be when the man said he didn't want to be interrogated, he went back to his cell, and that ended it. So obviously he wanted to talk to him. So I don't see why that's particularly relevant. It doesn't come as a huge surprise to any of us that the policeman wanted to talk to him and wanted to get a statement from him. That was the purpose of going in there.
Right, and you, Judge, you largely hit on my point here. He went in to do an interrogation, engaged Mr. Lockley, and what he said in response to being engaged was then used against him at trial. And that's custodial interrogation.
Okay, I'm not sure that his intent to go in there to conduct an interrogation is particularly relevant. It seems to me it's what's relevant is what was said by the two parties, because I don't think there's any dispute that the detective, who is a detective, went in to talk to him for the purpose of conducting an interrogation. The detective would say, well, I didn't do one because he didn't want to have one.
I actually respectfully disagree, Judge, that the officer's subjective intent is not an important factor here, because when you look at Bonilla Barraza, which the state cites in its answer brief, it lays out three criteria for evaluating whether an interrogation occurred. And one of those criteria is whether the officer's words or actions were calculated to elicit an incriminating response. And one of the other criteria is...
Well, I think where the dispute would come up is whether or not the words and actions here were calculated to elicit a response. I think that's different than saying he went into the room for the purpose of conducting an interrogation. The question is whether the words and actions that he used were done for the purpose of an interrogation.
It seems that that would require us to somehow split a time at which that an officer can walk into a room with the intent to conduct an interrogation, but some of what happens first is not an interrogation. And in some circumstances, that might be the case. I mean, there is case law out there saying that a mere explanation of somebody to the fact that they're about to be interrogated, why the interrogation is about to happen, statements made spontaneously during that time might not qualify for suppression under Miranda. But here, and what we see is that as soon as the officer walks in, there's no, hey, do you want a glass of water? These are your rights. We're going to interrogate you. The first thing right off the bat is you're under arrest for sex assault. And then as soon as Mr. Lockley tries to explain himself, as one would expect someone to do if they'd just been told that they were under arrest for sex assault, the officer then contradicts what Mr. Lockley is saying. And that sort of contradiction, that poking of holes in Mr. Lockley's story, and that would indicate, a reasonable officer should know that would indicate to the subject of the interrogation that he wants information. And that's all that we have to show here, that he's trying to get information.
So is it your position that once the officer advises the person who's in custody why he's in custody, anything said after that is subject to the product of an interrogation?
These are all factually intense evaluations. And when you look at the case law in this area, it's very difficult to say that any single behavior by a police officer will in all circumstances indicate the start of an interrogation. And I think that you could make a strong argument that had the officer walked into that holding cell and just stared at Mr. Lockley for long enough, slapping a baton in his hand, that might have eventually, at some point, been the functional equivalent of interrogation, been a clear signal that the officer was looking for the subject of interrogation to give some information. And that's what we're looking for here.
Let's look at the specific facts here again in terms of how the officer actually describes it. First thing that happens is he says he's under arrest. doesn't ask him anything. He says, you're under arrest. And the very next thing that happens, as I understand the record, is that the defendant says, he's the one who then says, asks the officer, does this have anything to do with the girl at the bus stop? So then the officer responds and says, yeah, it does. Then the defendant makes a statement, and then we've got this very controversial statement, I said, yes, it did. So does this case come down to those five words?
It does, indeed. And that, I mean, those five words were stressed over and over again by the state in closing argument. And they were very prejudicial to Mr. Lockley. So yes, I mean, it is those words, the part that she slept on the couch.
No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the words, I said, yes, it did. Because the only other thing the officer said before that was responding to a question from the defendant. And the statement that you're concerned about that so you say is so prejudicial is, comes after the statement, I said, yes, it did. And those five words, is it those five words that create this sense of now you're under interrogation?
Well, when you go back to People v. Wood, it's, yes, those five words are the crux, but you have to look at the entire situation, the fact that he had just been taken into custody after a warrantless arrest in his home, the fact that he was isolated in a holding cell, chained to a bench, and this officer walked in and stood over him and then informed him that he had been that he was being accused of some very serious charges. And that, just like in Wood, all of that goes into setting the stage for when those five critical words were delivered, that was the functional equivalent of interrogation. And I would like to reserve some time for rebuttal unless the court has more questions.
All right, Mr. Evans, you've got about 3 minutes.
If it pleases the court, my name is Chris Bosk, attorney registration number 39036, representing the people in this matter. Clearly, the issue of custodial interrogation is going to be the important one here, so I'll address that first. An interrogation occurs where there's direct questioning or it's functional equivalent. I don't think anybody disagrees here that there was no direct questioning. The record makes that clear. So the issue turns on whether there was the functional equivalent of direct questioning. Functional equivalent of direct questioning are words or actions that the officer should have known would be likely to result in the defendant making an incriminating statement. Obviously, the transcript is critical here, and I think this court is reading it correctly, reading it the way I did. The defendant was cuffed, handcuffed in a holding cell. We don't dispute that he was in custody. The officer walked in and said, Mr. Lockley, you're under arrest for sexual assault. A defendant has a right to know what he's doing at the police station. Explaining what he's doing there is a statement that's normally attendant to arrest in custody and not interrogation. The defendant responded by asking the detective a question. He asked, does this have something to do with the girl at the bus stop? And you're absolutely correct. The detective answered, yes, it did. In other words, yes, this has something to do with the girl at the bus stop. He's not contradicting the defendant. He's not trying to poke holes in anything he said. He's simply answering a question. And a question that was posed spontaneously and of the suspect's own initiative. After that, he made the statement that's apparently at issue here. There's just no reading of this transcript that would allow us to find interrogation occurred up until the point where he made this statement. We don't really go into this, at least we haven't yet, but it's worth noting that, yes, the detective mentioned later on, well, I'd like to hear your side of the story. I mean, arguably, this would have been a good time for a Miranda warning, but as the record shows, this is the moment where the defendant invoked his own right to remain silent.
Mr. Bosk,
please.
We can understand the clear example of when interrogation begins. I suspect that in a case like this, the detective comes in, he has some sort of waiver that can be signed and informs the suspect that he can have a lawyer if he chooses, but he doesn't have to have a lawyer. And if he wants to waive his rights, he can sign the document. That's clearly when a formal interrogation begins. As I understand Mr. Evans' argument, the police have to be cautious, and the first words out of their mouth ought to be a Miranda warning.
Well,
I'm not sure I read the law that way, but I gather that's his argument, that in the when they're shade, when they're, there's a penumbra, and you can't really tell whether the thing is a declaratory statement, an exclamation, or a question, doubt ought to be resolved in favor of the defendant.
Well, I think Mr. Evans and I would agree on one thing for sure, and that's that the better practice would be to give a Miranda warning at the very beginning. Considering the amount of time we've both spent on this issue, that certainly would have been the better practice here. But the key issue is not what's the better practice, it's what does the law require. And the law requires a Miranda warning when a defendant is in custodial interrogation, and he simply was not the subject of interrogation leading up to the point where he made that statement, or really at any time thereafter. And that's the critical question in this case. So I would disagree with Mr. Evans on that point, although I do agree that that's the argument he's making.
Should we defer somewhat to the trial judge? And what we're reading, we're trying to interpret a written transcript. The trial judge actually heard the testimony and might have had a better understanding of, through body language and other things, of what exactly the detective meant when he said, "I said yes, it did." I mean, is that an area where we should give deference to the trial judge?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think that's clearly an area where the trial judge saw things unfold before him or her. The fact of the matter here is that the transcript is pretty clear. If we read the words on their face value, he's answering the suspect's question very simply and in a very straightforward manner, not really inviting more commentary, not trying to poke holes in anything he's saying, not positing the guilt of the suspect, not engaging in a relationship building effort, just answering a question.
Mr. Bosco, I agree that the transcript, it appears that the defendant here was waiting to talk to the detective. And as soon as he had an opportunity, he just bubbled up everything he could possibly say about the event. On the other hand, I think Mr. Evans' perspective is that the simple phrase, "yes, it did," was the functional equivalent of taking the baton and smacking it against the palm, because it was a confrontational statement. That's the point at which an argument arose between the detective and the suspect.
Well, I would respectfully disagree, Your Honor, because there was no confrontation in the asking or answering of that question. The suspect asked, "Does it have?" Detective answered, "Yes, it does." They actually agreed in some sense on what was going on there. There was no confrontation. There was no disagreement. It was an asking and an answering of a question.
Well, let me follow through on that a little bit, because it may not be quite that simple. I'm concerned about, this brings back Bill Clinton kinds of statements, but the use of the word "it." I mean, it doesn't make any sense in context here. The first question of the defendant was, "Does this have anything to do with the girl at the bus stop?" The policeman says, "You bet it does." Then he says, "Well, the defendant told me he didn't do anything with the girl he helped at the bus stop. I said, yes, it did." What in the world does "it" mean?
It is something.
But, I mean, Mr. Evans' argument is that contextually and grammatically, the only thing it can mean is "you."
You know, to the extent that there's any confusion here, I think the way to solve it is by looking at the question that the suspect asked. Does it have something to do with the girl at the bus stop? Yes. He didn't appear confused by the answer that he received from the detective. So I think it's safe to assume that the detective was answering his question clearly. Does it have something to do with? Yes, it does, or did, rather, in past tense. And I think this goes to your statement, Your Honor, that, you know, this is a sort of a cold record. It's hard to really read people's responses. It's hard to know what exactly he meant by it or something. But to the extent that there was any confusion, I think the question that the suspect himself asked clarifies that area. I would just like to note briefly that something else to keep in mind here is that any error here, and we clearly disagree that there was one, but any error has to be considered harmless in light of the overwhelming evidence presented against this defendant. A DNA test showed to a near certainty that he had indeed had sexual contact with the victim. The employee found the victim shortly after she was released from the defendant's apartment in the same neighborhood, testified that she was distraught, bruised, and swollen. Police officers and a doctor testified to the same. An exam, a physical exam, showed abrasions near her genital area that were probably inflicted within the last 12 hours, clearly suggesting something other than a consensual sexual encounter. And when she looked at the photo lineup and saw a picture of the defendant, she'd been shaking and crying, which also clearly suggests something other than a consensual sexual encounter, which is what he suggests happened here. So there was no error here, but to the extent that any can be found, it has to be considered harmless. I think that takes care of this issue. If there are any other questions from the court concerning the other issues, I'd be happy to discuss them. But in the event that there aren't, I would thank the court for your time and ask that you affirm the convictions, and I'd rest on the people's brief with respect to the other issues.
Thank you, Mr.
I do have a question. If
please.
It's like there's still a little time remaining.
Oh, yeah.
Talking about the arrest, didn't the defendant already have more than enough time to destroy any evidence he was going to destroy, to clean up, wash, all that sort of thing? I mean, there was somewhere between 24 and 36 hours had passed since the incident. And so what was the, how could there conceivably be an exigency that would justify not waiting for a warrant to be issued under those circumstances?
Absolutely. You know, I the question isn't what could the suspect have conceivably done with the time that he had leading up to the warrantless arrest. The question is what could the, it's an objective test essentially based on what the police reasonably could have expected. Well, in my opinion, the fact that some amount of time had passed before they were able to go in there and secure the location really goes to the point that if he was going to do anything, he clearly would have been in the process of doing it or would be thinking about doing it very shortly thereafter. Obviously, we can't justify a belief in exigent circumstances based on what we find later on, but when they went in there, it was a washing machine full of clothes covered in blood and feces. So, you know, again, can't justify the belief, but it's perfectly reasonable for the officers in this case to be concerned about a person who had already exhibited a state of mind that was concerned with, you know, fleeing from the police, changing his clothes, lying to them about his identity. It was reasonable for the police to believe that he could have been at that point in the process of destroying evidence, which, as it so happens, he was.
To one other question. You've indicated in your brief that you would, that the state agrees that the minimus should be corrected to remove one of the sexual assault convictions. So you're agreeable that one of those convictions should be vacated then?
I do agree with that, Your Honor.
Okay.
I think the record pretty clearly reflects that the people only intended to charge the one count.
Thank you.
So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Boss.
Thank you.
Mr. Evans, you have about 3 minutes left.
There are a couple of quick factual issues that I'd like to clear up here. The first of which is that the doctor who examined the victim in this case testified that he could not exclude consensual sex as the cause of the abrasions around the victim's genital area. That's volume 11, page 56. Second, the it statement that we've been tossing around this whole time, the Attorney General referenced that That was in response to a question by Mr. Lockley. And when you look at the transcript, it says, he told me he didn't do anything with the girl he helped at the bus stop. I said, yes, it did. The officer was not answering a question here. He was responding to a statement by Mr. Lockley trying to explain himself. Now, Judge Graham, you indicated that my position was that the first words out of a police officer's mouth should be the Miranda warnings whenever they're in contact with the suspect. And no, of course there are practical reasons why you would say all sorts of other things, but those should be the first words out of a police officer's mouth before taking something from a suspect that they're going to then use against them in court. I mean, this isn't about what conversations police can have with suspects. It's about what information can come into court and be used against a suspect. And before that happens, yes, absolutely, those Miranda warnings should be delivered. Now, the last thing I'd like to address is to come back to the harmlessness argument here. And a rational trier of fact in this case could have decided to discredit the victim's testimony here. There was evidence presented that she had a history of fighting with her boyfriend, which sometimes resulted in leaving the house for days at a time. There was evidence presented that crack cocaine may have been involved that night, and there was evidence that she lied to the police in the past. So this is not a situation where there was no theory of defense and no way that the jury could have found in favor of Mr. Lockley. And the standard of review that this court is bound to is that if there's any reasonable possibility that this information contributed to the verdict, then it was not harmless and it has to be reversed. And when you look at closing arguments, you see the state emphasizing what happened in that cell over and over again. You see the prosecution telling the jury, you have DNA evidence, and then immediately contrasting that to what the defendant said, I didn't do anything with that girl, she slept on my couch, and then telling the jury, the crime lab tells you something different. And then again, in rebuttal, prosecutor says, at the time the defendant made the statement to Detective Lopez, I didn't do anything with that girl, there was not a one in quadrillion direct evidence establishing that, in fact, he did do something to that girl. So this was not harmless. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Thank you again, Mr. Bosk. And thanks to both counsel for your good arguments. They were illuminating. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.